disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please consider supporting us. Head over to www.deadsoulspodcast.com and see how you can donate to our research and investigations and find other ways to support us. We really appreciate you stopping by. You can also find us over on Instagram if that's more your thing. Just search Dead Souls Podcast and we'll come up. As always, thank you for joining us. Germany, under National Socialist rule, was meant to be a society unlike any other. That was Adolf Hitler's ultimate ambition. His dream was to be the head of the greatest nation on earth. Technologically, militarily, scientifically, and culturally, Germany sets its sights on being the utopian envy of the world. Berlin was to be renamed Germania and would become the most developed and prosperous city in all of history. The magnificence of Germanization would leave other famed empire capitals like London, Rome, and Athens a mere shadow in comparison. Yet, just 12 years after Hitler's meteoric rise to power, Berlin is devastated, laying in ruins following a sustained and heavy obliteration from Allied air and ground raids. Any surviving citizens live in squalor and depression, with almost all amenities destroyed and supply lines lost. Berlin is a wasteland of rubble, human bodies and dust, existing now in the echo of gunfire, the roar of T-34 tanks, and the faint cry of death. There is no food, no clean water, and the ruins of a once opulent city might as well be the surface of the moon, as survival in this environment is incredibly limited. Deep beneath the rubble are the cramped confines of a bunker built to house the leadership of Nazi Germany before the end came. Known to the Nazi elite as the Führer Bunker, Hitler and his Nazi vision for Germany were by now symbiotically connected as both faced impending oblivion. These are the final days and footsteps of Adolf Hitler, the first and final Führer of the Third Reich. This is Fallen Tenet, Berlin, May 1945. Construction on the Führer Bunker for the Nazi leadership in Berlin began in 1936 in an eerily preemptive step. It began life as a simple air raid shelter before its role was expanded as Germany's wartime footing and position grew more and more dire toward the end of 1944. The bunker was located in the Reich Chancellery Building Gardens, situated in the heart of Berlin. The bunker comprised of two interconnected shelters, with the original shelter becoming known as the upper or forward bunker, while the second lower bunker became the Führer Quarters. The Führer Quarters section was some 2.5 to 3 meters deeper underground and was given substantial additional protection, specifically a concrete roof being 3 meters thick, which was intended to prevent all but the heaviest and most direct hits of Allied bombs from penetrating the subterranean structure. The bunker also had the infrastructure so that the Führer and his senior staff could continue to command Germany's war efforts from there, as well as the defense of the city, as bombs and artillery rained down relentlessly from above. By spring of 1945, however, communications to forces by way of telephone and radio became unreliable, and Hitler and his senior staff eventually resorted to using boys from the Hitler Youth as runners, carrying written messages to the few remaining officers of the Wehrmacht who were within reach. One such young runner was Armin D. Lehmann, who was just 16 years old at the time, and who would find himself face to face with a Führer, a man that he idolized. Lehmann, who eventually settled in Oregon after the war, recalled how the belief in the Führer still reigned supreme even in those bleak and dark final days within the bunker. He remembered it never entered his mind that even then a as the bombs rained down that Germany could possibly lose the war. Hitler had been forced to take up residence in the bunker on January the 16th, 1945. Despite propaganda to the contrary, the Führer seldom spent any time in Berlin during the war, choosing instead to spend all of his time at the Burghof near Berchtesgaden in Obersalzburg. But now he was underneath the capital city, accompanied by his mistress, Eva Braun, with his mental health slowly deteriorating. Hitler was suffering with extreme stress and anxiety, in addition to the onset of Parkinson's disease. To further his woes, Hitler was also in the throes of severe drug withdrawals and was completely unaware of it. Since 1936, Hitler's personal physician, Dr. Theodor Moral, had prescribed him a constant daily dose of bovine hormone, Dolantin, Eucadol, twice daily administrations of cocaine, for an ear problem, and Pervitin. These were in addition to over 30 other vitamins, supplements and tonics all administered by injection. The only problem now was that the British had bombed the Merck pharmaceutical factory where Hitler's drugs were produced, and they were now difficult to come by. These drugs were pharmaceutical names for heroin, cocaine and methamphetamine, or crystal meth, some of the strongest and most controlled substances by today's standards. Hitler was furious at the lack of availability of his medications, and he fired Moral in early April 1945. He was left to be treated by physicians Ernst Schenck and Werner Haas, who also couldn't provide the drugs Hitler craved. The pain of withdrawal racked Hitler, whose veins were all but now collapsed and broken. Witnesses say they saw Hitler in a desperate and depraved, sweaty mess, hacking at his veins in his arm with a pair of gold tweezers, pained by his lack of drugs. Hitler was also a big believer in German technological and scientific superiority. He clung to the belief that wonder weapons like the ME-262 jet fighter, the V-2 ballistic missile, and the Panzer VIII Maus super heavy tank would reverse Germany's fortunes. He held a desperate belief in his scientists making a breakthrough any day now on Germany's very own atomic bomb, which he would use to flatten London, New York and Washington. But these beliefs, like many others, detached him from the reality of the situation at hand. The infrastructure to support such weapons had slowly been pummeled into dust by Allied bombers. That and any scientist capable of producing a bomb on an atomic scale had long fled Germany for the UK or United States. Hitler lived in a drug-fueled haze of fairy tales and grandiose dreams, and by April 1945, these dreams were crumbling, much like his Reich. The bunker itself also served to detach Hitler even further from the real world that he was living in. It had been lavishly decorated with antique furniture and included a wall of Hitler's favourite paintings, in particular a piece depicting that of Frederick the Great. The bunker was afforded a well-stocked wine cellar and fully packed pantry, all protected and cared for by the service personnel provided to the Führer within the bunker. The war situation became an almost metatextual affair for Hitler, something that couldn't possibly reach him, but at the same time affected his ability to lead Germany's defence as the noose closed in between March and April of 1945. Those he shared the bunker with knew the truth. It was a prison of despair, and many of them looked for ways to distract themselves from their dark reality and impending doom. Martin Bormann, Hitler's much-despised private secretary, became well known within the bunker for making trips to the wine cellar and indulging in his trademark debauchery with women whom were hiding in the shelter from the Soviet army, who were known to commit widespread sexual crimes against women. The decadence of those in the bunker in the early spring of 1945 shook the beliefs of even a committed young Nazi like the 16-year-old Lehmann. He witnessed it firsthand for himself, stunned by what he saw, only having to, moments later, emerge back into the carnage of the street fighting between Berlin's defenders and the ever-looming Red Army. On one specific occasion, Lehmann was ordered to the bunker to collect a communication for dispatch. Upon arrival, he witnessed an orgy of sex, drugs, and alcohol, led by Bormann and a few other senior military leaders. Lehmann was horrified to see this. Then, immediately outside the bunker, he found two starving men carving up a wounded horse for food, the animal still alive and in pain. Such was the desperation for the ordinary citizen. By the beginning of April 1945, around 2.5 million Soviet soldiers had advanced upon the German capital, and within 2 weeks they had both reached the city centre, but also completely surrounded Berlin. There was no escape, no matter the determined and frenzied German resistance. For the remainder of the month, Hitler would stay confined underground, the Red Army just a few hundred yards away, slowly chipping away at the Nazi defenders. Soviet leader Joseph Stalin was adamant, almost manic, in his certainty that none of the Nazi leadership were to escape. Stalin's hatred for Hitler and the Nazis was so strong that he wanted to witness their destruction himself firsthand. Almost all communication from the bunker with the rest of Germany, that was at least technically still under German control, was now lost. The reality of the situation was now that many German commanders were finding themselves without a Führer for the first time. A leader who had previously insisted on personally directing and micromanaging much of the war efforts himself. Further, Hitler by now also found that his orders were also starting to be ignored, especially if those receiving them felt that they were suicidal or unreasonable. This led Hitler to fly into an unsolvable rage, with witnesses claiming that he appears to suffer from a nervous breakdown at this time, and his mind and communication drastically changed. It was from this point that Hitler, for the first time, declared that the war was lost. Hitler began questioning his physicians over the most reliable method of suicide, leading many in the bunker to feel that they were part of a suicide pact. Head of the Luftwaffe, Hermann Göring, offered to resume the leadership of Germany, stating that he felt Hitler had become incapacitated as the Führer. Hitler, however, viewed this offer as treason and demanded Göring's resignation from all of his posts and to be arrested immediately. The bunker also received news from, ironically, the BBC, in which Hitler learned that Heinrich Himmler, the once fiercely loyal and vaunted head of the SS, had communicated with the Western Allies. Himmler believed Hitler to be dead, and he had assumed the role of the Führer. He had also offered to surrender what was left of Germany, but only surrender it to the United Kingdom and United States, specifically not to the Soviet Union. The offer was quickly declined by the Allies. Upon learning of this act, Hitler was outraged and ordered that Himmler be arrested and executed for treason. Hermann Feiglin, who was in the Führer bunker having been arrested the day before on charges of desertion, was shot in the Chancellery Gardens in place of Himmler and as a warning to others. Eva Braun pleaded with Hitler to spare Feiglin's life, as he was married to her sister Gretel, who was due to give birth a few days later. This didn't resonate with Hitler, however, who ordered his death regardless. On April the 28th, 1945, reports reached the bunker that the Red Army had now reached the Potsdamer Platz, which was in the centre of Berlin, less than a kilometre away from the bunker itself. Hitler's mind and mental stability at this point was now at its lowest. The pressures, the certainty of impending death, the drug withdrawals and illnesses he was suffering with, Hitler knew his time was up, and both his army and Reich were in tatters. Berlin was destroyed. Germania was now just a pipe dream, and even his most trusted inner circle were deserting him. All that was left for Hitler to do was to make the preparations for his own death so that, in one act of defiance, he could at least, to a degree, go out on his own terms. That same night, shortly after midnight, in the early hours of April 29th, Hitler made what he saw to be a gesture of kindness. As an appreciation for her service and loyalty to him, Hitler married Eva Braun. It is unlikely that Hitler ever loved Braun. He never expressed it. But Braun loved Hitler. Hitler knew he could trust her, and that meant a lot to him. Geli Rubol, Hitler's niece, was the only woman that Hitler ever loved. Those are his own words. Geli unfortunately had killed herself in 1931 after Hitler had become so obsessive over her that he kept her locked in his Munich apartment, and their sexual relationship descended into the bizarre, peculiar, and unnatural. Still, he was with Eva now. It had been intended that they marry earlier that day, but the official marriage paperwork was not in the bunker to make the marriage legitimate in the eyes of the law. This prompted Hitler's lawyer, Michael Wagner, to head out through the war-ravaged streets in an armoured car, evading Russian weapons and troops in order to obtain the correct paperwork. That was what was important to Hitler and Braun at that moment in time. Braun and Hitler had met when Eva was employed as an assistant to Hitler's official photographer in 1929, during the early years of his political career. Braun was from a middle-class Catholic background, just like Hitler, and she spent her time with Hitler largely out of public view to maintain Hitler's public image of celibacy and commitment to the Reich and the Reich only. Except for when it suited Nazi propaganda, obviously. Braun entertained herself by skiing and swimming. She enjoyed the cinema and playing with her two terrier dogs. She had little interest in politics and never got involved in Hitler's work or political opinions. Albert Speer, Hitler's architect and Nazi Minister of Armaments and War Production, famously said of Eva Braun, "Eva Braun will prove a great disappointment to historians." While she had no significant influence on Hitler's political career or his wartime decisions, she did provide him with a degree of normalcy in an otherwise extraordinary life, and so kept him grounded when he was prone to fits of fantasy or rage. She twice attempted to commit suicide to win Hitler's attention and affection in 1931 and 1935, which ultimately worked to her advantage. But she was loyal to the very end and refused to leave him in the Berlin bunker despite suggestions she take her chances and attempt to flee. Hitler had left her a generous annual payment of almost $862,000 in 2023 monetary equivalency. But Braun was too loyal and would not leave him. In fact, Braun's degree of loyalty, Hitler thought, was in short supply as he lived through his final hours and those around him began to abandon him. The marriage ceremony was witnessed by Martin Bormann and the Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. After a rather modest wedding reception and breakfast in the map room, Hitler and Braun emerged, accompanied by Goebbels, his wife Magda, and Hitler's private secretary Martin Bormann. Turning to Gerda Christian, a secretary of Hitler's, Eva pointed to the wedding ring on her finger and received her congratulations. Hitler then, with his second private secretary, Gertrude Trudy Jung, went into his office where he dictated his final will in the form of a political and personal testament. He instructed Joseph Goebbels and Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz to assume Hitler's roles as Chancellor and Head of State respectively following his death. Hitler also confided to Jung that the wedding had been an emotional experience, but that for him death would be only a means to personal redemption of his many worries and what had been a very difficult life. Hitler also laid out his wishes and made arrangements for what should be done to his body and his new wife's body once they were dead. News from Italy concerning the fate of his ally Benito Mussolini and his mistress Claretta Petacci had reached the bunker. The thought of being strung up, beaten, spat on and humiliated before an unceremonious execution horrified him. He wished to avoid this at all costs. In the early hours of April 30th, Hitler assessed his military tactical picture one last time. There would be no 11th hour reprieve. Miracles to save him or his Reich would never arrive. German forces in and around the city had been surrounded and were slowly being captured or killed. None of them could do anything to help him now. The Luftwaffe had all but ceased to exist, and all but the most radicalized Nazi pilots were taken to the air in an attempt to flee to the Western Allies, not wanting to be a prisoner at the hands of the Soviets. At around 0200 hours, Hitler began meeting with members of his staff in the bunker, including his doctor, Ernest Schenck. Schenck had previously worked at the Dachau concentration camp, where he participated in all manner of questionable and evil experiments on men, women and children. Somewhat ironic that he would now be treating Hitler. Schenck would later describe the Führer as looking like a diminished, hunched man with shaking limbs, bloodshot eyes and an expressionless face. The Führer thanked his staff for their work and then left the medical staff to engage in one last party, one that was attended by Eva Hitler. Amidst the celebrations, Schenck left in order to use the toilet and overheard a conversation between Hitler and SS physician Werner Haas, where Hitler explained that he wanted to die at the exact same time as his wife. The plan involved both Hitler and Eva taking cyanide pills and shooting each other at the same time. But Eva had confessed that she was worried that she wouldn't be able to shoot her new husband, fearing that the cyanide pill might fail. Hitler tested a capsule of the cyanide on his German shepherd, Blondie, and the animal died almost instantly. At 0600 hours, Soviet soldiers charged the chancellery building, but surprisingly were beaten back. Hitler was advised that it was less than 24 hours before the bunker was captured. An hour later, Hitler and his wife attempted to make their way out of the bunker in order to get one last look at the sunlight. Hitler and Eva barely made it to the entrance hall before the sound of the war, a war that he had instigated, forced the couple to retreat back down the staircase and into the bunker for a final time. Hitler and Braun ate lunch together later that day and then said thank you to each of the remaining staff who were in the bunker with them. Despite Hitler's previous orders that everyone had to fight until the last or be shot as a coward, Hitler finally lamented and advised many of them that at nightfall they should try and make a break for freedom and their lives, rather than be captured by the Soviet Red Army. At 14:30 hours, Hitler and Braun entered their private quarters and closed the door firmly behind them. It would be the final time that they would both be seen alive. Hitler's valet, Heinz Ling, and Martin Bormann entered the private room a few hours later after they noticed it had been silent for a while and discovered their lifeless bodies. The Führer, the man who had instigated the most devastated war in human history, who had inflicted enough suffering on an industrial scale upon millions, a leader who based his entire ideology on hatred, was dead. According to the testimonies of the staff who survived the bunker, the couple, who hadn't even been married for 2 days, were found sitting on the sofa. Eva was to the left of Hitler, who sat sunken over with blood pouring from a hole in his temple. He had shot himself while simultaneously biting down on a cyanide tablet. Braun, meanwhile, looked as if she was simply asleep. Comparatively pristine, witnesses said. The air in the room smelled strongly of almonds, an indication of the release of hydrogen cyanide. Staff wrapped Braun and Hitler's bodies in a rug, and the pair were carried upstairs and into the Chancellery garden. Behind the Chancellery, where Hitler would like to walk his dog Blondie before the outside became too dangerous, the pair were soaked in petrol, and then, with some difficulty, set on fire. The flames soon engulfed the bodies and destroyed them beyond any recognition, erasing one of the most evil men in history, destroying him, reducing him to a pile of carbon and ash. But while their bodies may have been gone, the legacy of the tyrant will live on in various forms to this day. The world was shaped by the heinous acts of Hitler and his warped ideology. The legacy that Hitler left and the memory of the Holocaust and the Second World War is a powerful reminder as to how far human hatred and pseudo-ideology can take us. They should act as a mark and strong reminder of what to avoid and how important it is to battle those elements from reoccurring. Sadly, only 80 years later, humanity routinely makes the same mistakes and commits similar acts. Are we forever doomed to repeat our ills until we finally destroy ourselves entirely? Maybe that's what mankind's destiny truly is. Self-destruction. Hitler and his twisted administration, hopped up on drugs, insane with power, and drunk with hatred, blamed the Jews for all that was wrong with the world. They tried to destroy them. They did the same with the Roma, the communists, the homosexuals, and the free-thinking intellectuals. Do you think once they eradicated all of these groups, that there would have been utopia? It's laughable. When things weren't perfect, who would they have blamed for their failings then? Would you have been next in the gas chamber? Tyrants and their wars continue to wage on almost every continent. The defeat and destruction of hatred seems to be a lesson we are yet to fully learn. In June 1945, the Soviets falsely announced that Hitler's remains had not been found and that he was still alive and in hiding somewhere around in Northern Europe. This announcement caused a flurry of supposed Hitler sightings across Europe. It also led to numerous conspiracy theories as to what really happened to Hitler and whether he escaped to South America. Allied officers sought to establish beyond all reasonable doubt that Hitler had indeed died in his bunker. They evidenced that he most certainly did. The bodies of Hitler and his wife were only partly destroyed by the fire and were later hastily buried in a shallow bomb crater. According to Russian reports, the bodies were exhumed by Soviet troops and taken to Magdeburg in East Germany, where Hitler's body was said to have been finally destroyed in April 1970 by the KGB. Only two fragments of the body, a jawbone and a piece of skull, were preserved. They were displayed in an exhibition at the Russian Federal Archives in Moscow in April 2000. Immediately after the war ended in Germany, the major cities were all devastated, in complete ruins. There was no food, no running water, no infrastructure of any sort, and millions of people were displaced and homeless. Any men discovered by Allied forces were arrested or shot. Many women suffered horrendous sexual abuse and rape, particularly in the Russian-occupied areas. Many children starved to death. The British military commander, General Bernard Law Montgomery, famously cautioned his troops at the time, saying, "We have won the German war. Let us now win the peace." The Allies concluded that Germany needed to be occupied after the war to assure a peaceful transition to a post-Nazi state. Their temporary solution to this was to organize Germany into four occupation zones, each administered by a different Allied army: the British, the Americans, the French, and the Russians. The British and Americans immediately set about rebuilding infrastructure and providing food and water in their zones. They also began a program of denazification amongst the citizens. This was a significant task given how widespread the Nazi ideology had flooded the German society. The German people initially had widespread fears of retribution. They projected paranoid fears of revenge from Jewish Holocaust survivors, Eastern European displaced persons, and American occupation officials. The Germans felt that the Americans had entered the war on behalf of world Jews, and that them and the Jewish Holocaust survivors would do to Germans what had been done to the Jews. They also expected attacks from Eastern Europeans after the total war that the Nazis had inflicted against Soviet Russia. These attacks and retribution never materialized, however. Most people wanted to forget the horrors of the war. But for a period of time, German society felt on edge, paranoid, scared. Paradoxically, the opposite happened. The number of Jewish survivors in post-war Germany increased rapidly from only 20,000 in 1945 to over 250,000 by 1947. The Western Allies of France, United Kingdom, and the United States eventually combined their zones into the state of West Germany, with the Soviet Union creating East Germany and erecting their border wall. On April the 3rd, 1948, President Truman signed the Economic Recovery Act of 1948. It became known as the Marshall Plan, named for Secretary of State George Marshall, who in 1947 proposed that the United States provide economic assistance to restore the economic infrastructure of post-war Europe. Whilst Germany, in its East and West split nations, returned to some economic and civic normalcy by the 1950s, due to the arrival of the Cold War, it didn't return to be a united sovereign nation until October 1990.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deathcult.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. There you can also find links to our socials, Patreon, and episodes. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.